From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. In pursuit of concepts such as the public interest or the common good, political historians examine the ethical and moral considerations implicit in debates over public policy. But does the notion of the public interest have any basis in fact? On that topic, Soundings presents a conversation with John Clark, a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of history at the University of Kansas.
It's not a buzzword, but whether it has genuine meaning is problematical. What you have here is a concept that's very vague. It's interpreted by different people in different ways. Some would maintain that it's a useless term to use in evaluating public policy or assessing the direction in which a society is going. However, I think that it's used frequently enough in a concrete way in public policy making that it therefore warrants a consideration. It is, after all, a term that's been used in various forms, synonymously with the common good or the common weal for centuries.
Is the notion of the common good or the public interest peculiar to democracies?
No. I'm sure it's not. I seem to recall that fascism, for instance, in the 20s, late 20s and 30s, when the regimes are just beginning to solidify, say, in Germany or Italy, refer to the public interest. I'm not sure whether they use those precise words, but it's the old ploy that Mussolini can make the trains run on time, bring a certain amount of efficiency to what had been a chaotic regime, and that this, therefore, would be in the public interest. Now, what's missing from a fascist construct of the public interest are what we might call humane values. The public interest, to me, is a term, or the common good, but we'll just use the public interest, a term that subsumes large values that a particular society cherishes in some way. One would be equity, which could be defined as a fair sharing of burdens and benefits without regard to categories that are irrelevant, like race or sex or age or national origin, religion, so on and so forth. Equity, then there would be justice, which is a kind of sharing of under a set of rules under which no one has a particular advantage over anyone else, and liberty. I'm not talking about human equality. I'm talking about a system which guarantees to each person an opportunity to benefit from the good of society, and should bad descend on society, share those burdens equally.
You're talking not about individual human characteristics so much as social institutions that humans create.
Yeah, exactly. It has to be institutionalized, and that's why, as I think you can talk about equity as a general social value, and that's a real bag of worms. But I think you can talk about equity more concretely in policy formulation. And it seems to me that one of the major criteria by which a policy must be evaluated is the degree to which it achieves its goal in an equitable way. Mm-hmm. Well, then you can make the same kind of measurement with justice, with liberty, the degree to which a policy furthers or diminishes liberty, all in our system within a democratic framework, or a framework of self-government, say.
John, can you give me a concrete example of a public policy in which these three elements, justice, equity and freedom or liberty converge?
Well, we can go back to the beginning of the country, not the colonization of the country, but the birth of the United States. The revolution is over by 1783. The Confederation government has been in operation for several years, and one of the first things that it does is pass a piece of legislation called the Northwest Ordinance. And it had several features to it. In the first place, it guaranteed that territories established by the new nation from the public domain would enter the United States of America on the same basis as the original states. An equity was established, an equitable procedure was established. It guaranteed trial by jury, all of those institutionalizations of justice, and it prohibited slavery north of the Ohio River. In other words, it extends the realm of liberty, freedom, to a people living north of the Ohio River. I suppose you could make the same sort of case in a much different way for any of the civil rights legislation that comes in the 1950s, the late 1950s, and on into the 1960s. Maybe the emphasis would be a little bit different. You're talking about political rights, liberty as the freedom to participate is guaranteed in the Constitution, but it needs protection from specific legislation, and so the Civil Rights Acts are passed. Liberty has another side to it, which is a freedom from oppression, the current debate over, I can't remember what title it is, but Title VII, I guess, of the Civil Rights Act, which requires the investigation of states to make sure that people have not been inhibited from casting their ballot, as a sort of guarantee against the old Jim Crow regime being applied to politics, as it was with grandfather clauses and poll taxes and literacy tests and so on. I believe that equity, justice, and liberty within a system of self-government are inherent in our basic documents. The Constitution, before that, the Declaration of Independence, shortly thereafter, the Bill of Rights, and several amendments to the Constitution, women's suffrage, and so on, that have been passed more recently. They're used, they're referred to constantly in a variety of contexts. No one would deny them. We are not. I hear no one promoting a concept of public interest that's based on inequity, injustice, and tyranny. Americans pay lip service to these ideals and frequently pursue them, which isn't to say that they frequently trample on them also. I think they are common values.
Well, John, what about the roles, whether they're necessary or desirable or undesirable, of special interest groups? You say that nobody is promoting tyranny, nobody is promoting inequity.
I think one can make the case, it's a liberal case, admittedly, that at the turn of the century and into the 20th century, organized labor fought for rights which it was in the public interest to grant, but which were denied for many decades because of the power of corporations. It was in the public interest that working men have some job security. Now, in the 1950s and thereafter, with Taft-Hartley, one gets a different view of the role of organized labor in society, and one hears a lot about feather bedding and the reduced productivity and higher labor costs without any benefits, without taking a position means that one needs to analyze the current role of organized labor, again, against this concept. concept. It could be, for instance, then that what you'd come up with is organized labor from what, 1880 through 1925 or 30, fighting the good fight. Fighting in a way that's consonant with the public interest. And since 1950, it could very well be that some major unions are self-serving.
So we have a checkered concept here.
Well, it's I think it's not the concept isn't checkered. It's the interest groups whose activity has to be measured against it that may rate high on my ranking in one era and low in another era.
Does the public interest or the idea of the common social good, does that imply social activism?
Well, if you started in a system of equality, take the theoretical state of nature, the Rousseauian or Lockean state of nature, and worked things out in an adequate way so that everybody was starting from the same position and there were all these rules to guarantee that no one really got done in unfairly, then you wouldn't necessarily have to be so active. But if you've got a society that has all kinds of structural inequities like American society does, you just can't allow nature to take its course. It implies a certain amount of activism.
What do you mean by structural inequities?
Structural inequity would be a system which in its totality functions to grant dramatically fewer benefits to identifiable segments of the population. Now, in America, blacks, of course, or minority groups, blacks, Indians, have, I don't think it can be denied, been oppressed for centuries. Slavery, Indian removal, genocide, so on. Women, also, children, the aged. Racism and sexism act to create a structure which fixes people who are black and women in a condition above which they really can't rise.
Well, then why is the United States supposed to be the greatest country in the world? Or is that just people in the United States talking? Is that the Chamber of Commerce?
Well, I suppose relatively, I mean, I happen to feel that relative to any other place, it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say that I would subscribe to the idea of love it or leave it. I think you can love it and criticize it, and I think that you can work for change, and I think there are plenty of areas in which change is dramatically needed. I mean, after all, one concrete case would be unemployment among black youths. We are creating in the United States today a generation of black youths who have never had a job, who have never done more than part-time work, and whose life opportunities are so limited by their race, by their lack of education, by the place they live, by health care or their health history, that it requires massive intervention from some source. Well, what's the source? One can say that voluntarism will carry the day. That's a good word to kick around today, voluntarism. President Reagan is talking about how the Mormons take care of one another. Let's adopt the Mormon system. But when you're talking about hundreds of thousands, millions of people who are hung up in a system out of which there's no escape, it's going to require more than the goodwill of their neighbor to get them out.
Well, what about the old-fashioned value of initiative and go get them and how... Has that gone by the by?
Oh, no. I mean, I think what you're talking about is the bootstrap philosophy, and there are obviously plenty of women and plenty of blacks and plenty of Indians and plenty of any of the disadvantaged groups who, by sheer will and a lot of luck and maybe a little help from their friends, have pulled themselves up out of the out of the average situation of one of their kind and have made careers for themselves and very, very prominent careers. But you can't judge a society by on the basis that Benjamin Franklin's are created, or Andrew Carnegie's, or John Hope Franklin's, one of our own, who is obviously a man who's overcome all kinds of disabilities with a lot of grace. Fame hasn't gone to his head, and yet is atypical of members of his own race. Now, most people don't have the extraordinary intelligence and maybe some of the advantages that Professor Franklin had. They are situated so low on the pecking order that they require public aid. Now, the public interest can be used here because it's in the public interest that these people be helped. For this reason, no society can afford to squander human resources. The human resources of the United States are its wealth now. It used to be land and human resources. Now it's the human beings that compose the United States. Well, if you add up the women who are relegated to particular roles, the blacks who are relegated to other roles, and other minority groups, plus the aged who are being forced out of their jobs at 65, in many institutions and corporations, you're wasting a heck of a lot of talent. Now, the United States, on the verge of the 21st century, can't afford to waste that kind of talent. It's in the public interest that blacks have jobs, that women have opportunity to compete on equality with men. Insofar as they're denied these opportunities, I'm being denied opportunities also. I can't really benefit in the long run from the disadvantages imposed on other people.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation with John Clark, a scholar at the center and a professor of history at the University of Kansas. Professor Clark is discussing the concept of the public interest as both theoretical and practical elements in American democracy.
In the past 250 years, the United States, as a nation, has certainly made some progress in moving close to this ideal. After all, the public interest is an ideal. It's nothing that's going to be achieved today, tomorrow, or in subsequent generations. It's simply a target to aim at. The closer you get to it, the better off we all are. We may move two steps forward in one set of years and a step backward in another set of years. The values themselves, I think, are ones that can't be denied. What one has to do now is, first of all, recognize that people don't fend for themselves, that middle-class Americans do not fend for themselves. Middle-class Americans for years have had all kinds of tax breaks in home ownership, tax breaks in income tax, advantages in job opportunities if they're WASP, the GI Bill, FHA, programs like this have given greater advantages to some than to others. If you happen to be a farmer, the great yeoman farmer, the individualist par excellence in the United States, most of his income is transfer income from the federal government through crop payments or set-aside programs, whatever it happens to be. We've just gone through that big squabble with peanuts and tobacco in North Carolina. These are benefits aimed at one group, which other groups are paying. for in prices and so on. So individualism, while certainly it can't be ignored, is a much different thing today than it was when Daniel Boone was carving up bears in Kentucky.
So in this tension between efficiency on the one hand and the ideal of the public interest on the other, you would opt for the ideal. You would say, okay, let's decrease the efficiency of the system as we know it in order to bring minorities, for instance, into the system.
Well, in order to bring everybody into the system. Democracy is not an efficient form of government. What we do is trade off certain efficiencies for other advantages. Freedom, for instance. Now, what we have to do is guard against adopting or becoming obsessed with the gospel of efficiency if, in doing that, we detract from the application of certain standards, which we cherish, again, equity and justice and freedom. Now, if you want a society that has high survival possibilities, that can cope with the kinds of tensions that technology will introduce in the next, within the next generation, within my lifetime and my children's lifetime, you better use your people as wisely as possible, because it's the people themselves that are going to determine the ultimate fate of the nation. And any system which denies to people the chance to fulfill themselves is committing suicide in the long run.
But there seems to be a kind of a contradiction, or again, a tension. On the one hand, I think it's fair to say that most people are not actively interested in government. Many people are just flatly indifferent to it. And yet when the government gets too big and begins to push them around, they squeal and they say, no, take the government off of our backs. We're good people. We can think good thoughts and work toward the public the common good, the public interest, as you've described it.
Yes, Americans have always been very suspicious of big government, and properly so. You have to be very careful of government. It's grasping. It tends to aggrandize itself at the expense of individual freedom. But by the same token, we do have this sense that an engorged federal government can be a danger. We recognize this collectively, and we manifest it from time to time. But by the same token, one has to recognize that some functions of government have developed within the past 25, 30, 40 years on demand of people. It's in the New Deal, for instance, that a labor maintains a certain legitimacy for the first time, attains a certain legitimacy for the first time. It's in the 1960s and the 1970s that there are some halting gains made by blacks. It's government who really forces this. I mean, after all, if there weren't the threat of a ticket, nobody would stop at a red light. People are not voluntarily going to be good in the public sense of the word. There has to be the threat of coercion. I'm not talking about a stick over somebody's head wielded by brown shirts. I'm talking about coercion through courts of law where the rules of the game are the same for everybody.
How does the notion of the public interest fit in with American foreign policy, with the fact that America has a citizenship in the world?
The public interest is the term commonly used, I think, up until World War II. After World War II, the national interest is used more and more as security questions became more and more important, especially during the Cold War. One hears very little about the public interest, but much about the national interest. And it seems to me, as one looks at the way we studied resource use, that the questions being asked by various commissions, the Paley Commission in the 1950s, the question being asked was not how should resources be used to serve the public interest, but how should they be used to serve the national interest? The assumption being that the national interest was even a larger set of values that subsumed even the public interest. And it's been lost sight of. The public interest has been lost sight of in the past 20 years, I think. It was commonly used in legislation. If you take a look at the Federal Communications Act and many other acts in the 1930s, you'll find dozens of references to the public interest. The Federal Power Commission bill, for instance, talks about public convenience and necessity for the building of pipelines and transmission wires and whatnot. But World War II turns our interests around a little bit and focuses them overseas. And of course, the atomic bomb gave to anybody who could build one the possibility of blowing up a good part of the United States. I think they ought to be separated out in certain questions. I think there are questions of domestic policy that one needs to consider in terms of my traditional view of the public interest. There are other questions. Energy questions have to be considered both as national security questions and in the domain of the public interest, but that these distinctions can be made. I don't think there are very many people in the United States who really care too much about the condition of people around the world. We're pretty myopic in our views. I'm not a one-worlder or anything like that, but I do see I see an unfortunate tendency of people who are involved in these negotiations to try and make much of them when they're really very simple kinds of questions. The more difficult questions really have to do with how do you get income into the pockets of Americans so they can live the good life. How do you get income into the pockets of people so that they can create a family environment that is conducive to self-fulfillment? Now, that's a tough question, because you're going to have to take from somebody to give to somebody else initially. Somebody's going to have to pay for the progress that we make. Now, I justify that by assuming a kind of collective American responsibility for the ills in society. That even if my dad did it, which he didn't, but even if my dad and his dad were really the guys who messed things up, since I derive benefit from America, then I also have to be responsible for the problems that it's created. So it's my responsibility to rectify the ills of the past. Now, a lot of people don't buy the notion of collective guilt passed on generation after generation, but they do buy the notion of accepting accumulated benefits. Now, you can't have one without having the other. And whatever you do, you have to measure it against something. And whether you accept this view of the public interest or construct your own, it's a useful concept to have in order to measure every policy against. A policy which does not fit your criteria of the public interest is a policy you should be opposing.
John Clark is a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of history at the University of Kansas. At the center, Professor Clark is writing a book about American fuel resource policies in the first half of the 20th century. You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center with an invitation for you to listen this week for Soundings. The topic this week is the public interest, and my guest is John Clark, a scholar at the National Humanities Center who teaches history at the University of Kansas. In pursuit of concepts such as the common good or the public interest, Professor Clark examines the ethical and moral considerations implicit in debates over public policy. Be listening for the insights this week on Soundings.